show number 170. I just turned off the computer. I forget. Part 12, I think it is. Mark Curtis's fascinating, educational, in the true sense, book, Secret Affairs, British Collusion with Radical Islam. Only a couple of chapters to go, which could translate to two shows. There's a lot to it, but try to get to it. Outdoors, in case you hear noises, it's a lovely Easter Sunday, and I think how un-Christian the geopolitics is by the many who claim to be so. All right, chapter 19, Allied to the Enemy, Iraq and Afghanistan. Anglo-American attempts to shape the Middle East in accordance with their interests have largely failed in Iraq and Afghanistan. In Iraq, planners have been unable to impose their will on the country following the March 2003 invasion and U.S. strategy, with Britain in tow, has continually and often desperately shifted. And also, there was a recent report about the billions of dollars that were lost. It was a Lee Camp VIP interview with an Iraqi veteran who got woke, and he described seeing pallets of money being taken somewhere for like week or weeks. So, you know, billions of dollars just disappeared. The impact of the occupation has been devastating. The number of deaths has been fiercely contested, but it is likely to be in the hundreds of thousands and possibly over 1 million. I gotta stop right there, because that's just, I mentioned this over and over in my writings, because I find it one of the key points to make. The insanity, the absurdity, and now with the chemical supposed chemical stuff in Syria with no evidence and bombing starting in somebody in political in Bolivia, and others have called to attention. Hello, this is how, you know, stuff started with Iraq. Initially, the Bush administration believed it would simply install favored pro-U.S. Iraqi exiles in power in Baghdad. When it became clear these figures were unpopular and incapable, the U.S. resorted to direct rule to try to install a neoconservative state. When this dream largely evaporated, Washington gave in to the demand for free elections, which it initially opposed and which mainly empowered the Shias in the center and south of the country and the Kurds in the north. Faced with a rising resistance movement among both Sunnis and Shias, Washington then embarked on a surge in the number of U.S. forces and an attempt to incorporate Sunni groups into its military strategy, reversing the original policy of de-Ba'athification, which had purged Iraqi institutions of personnel from Saddam's ruling party. It goes on and on and on and on. Rather, the elected Iraqi governments, notably those under Shia Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, after 2006, have become increasingly authoritarian, while the country has become increasingly divided along sectarian lines. That's what I see as the key there. The divide and conquer, you know, the gist of things is that Saddam was no saint, but the U.S. and the allies unleashed this division among sectarian lines, and now, you know, this chaos. In invading, Britain and the U.S. sought to maintain overall control over, wait for it, Iraqi's oil by ensuring a strong pro-Western government in Baghdad to establish bases in the country, to police the region, and to further resist the spread of Iranian influence. Their strategy has been confronted by various strands of resistance to the occupation, including Sunni nationalist groups in the center of the country, Shia militias in Baghdad, and terrorists linked to, wait for it, Al-Qaeda, who have conducted numerous suicide bombings. Al-Qaeda was initially handed a massive boost by the occupation, seeing the war as a further opportunity for recruiting jihadists, though its importance as a strategic actor in Iraq has declined since the death of its leader in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in 2006. Washington and London have also had to contend with regional states competing to promote their interests in post-Saddam Iraq. Iran has been supporting Shia groups trying to prevent a return to a Sunni-run dictatorship. Syria has wanted to see a pro-Damascus regime in Baghdad and has been backing some of the Sunni insurgents. Turkey is opposed to an independent or more powerful Kurdistan in the north for fear of the effects on its own Kurdish minority. And here we have the important aspect of the invasion and occupation of Iraq related to this story in this book is how Britain, following the U.S. lead, worked through Islamist groups to try and achieve its goals, or rather to mitigate its failure in Iraq. In predominantly Shia southern Iraq, where Britain led the occupying forces until its withdrawal of combat troops in 2009, it relied on some while opposing other Shia militias to enforce order and eventually its own exit. In the center of the country, a similarly sectarian strategy was supported by Britain in backing U.S. attempts to arm and empower Sunni groups, some of whom had links to, wait for it, Al-Qaeda to counter the insurgency. Next section is Islamizing southern Iraq. Shias, who made up the majority of the population, had been brutally suppressed under Saddam's rule, and Sunnis had dominated Iraq ever since Britain had created the country and put King Faisal on the throne in 1921. In August 2002, the run-up to the invasion, the U.S. invited Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, SCIRI, to an opposition gathering in Washington, along with five other groups. Blah, blah, blah. I just gotta skip ahead, otherwise I'll never get through this stuff. Washington may have sought to establish a new center of Shiism in Iraq to counter that in Iran. There's a mention of Sharia law-based society and the monopoly of the higher clergy in interpreting Islamic traditions. Key word, interpreting. Representing this, various people representing the Shia middle class and with little popularity in the country. The Sadrists, by contrast, are a mass movement centered in Baghdad and with a base in many of the power Shia districts of the country. All militias have indulged in atrocities in Iraq. Anglo-American connivance with ISCI developed while the later established secret detention centers, practicing torture on its enemies and sending out death squads to assassinate opponents. And subsequently, British policy towards the Shia militias varied incongruously from trying to counter them to turning a blind eye to their brutal activities through to direct support for them. The failure of the British forces to provide adequate security for the population after the collapse of the state meant that the vacuum was filled by the militias. Another study, U.S. study noted that the South had become a kleptocracy where well-armed political criminal mafiosi have locked both the central government and the people out of power. In 2007, the Ministry of Defense stated that we will work with any groups wishing to reduce violence and join the democratic process working towards a safer and prosperous Iraq. End quote. A comment showing that unintended humor remains a feature of government public relations operations. A senior British official was reported as saying that our leaving basically means that the extremist militias have less excuse to engage in lawlessness and violence. And here's another last show. We had Ed Balls, and this show is the Ministry of Defense denied that a deal had been done while Air Chief Marshal Sir Jock Stirrup, Chief of the Defense Staff, later claimed that the operation was the, quote, crowning success of the British policy of training Iraqi forces to deal with security. He added that, quote, we drew up plans to confront the militias, but the Iraqi government did not want us to implement them, end quote. April 30th, 2009, British declared an end to combat operations, and he began to hand over military authority in Basra, ostensibly to a U.S. force. Gordon Brown said that, quote, we hope to sign an agreement with the Iraqi government about the future role that we can play in training and in protecting the oil supplies of Iraq, end quote. Some British military personnel would also remain at U.S. military headquarters in Basra. So there again, as mentioned last show, you don't have to read between the lines, but the way the corporate, or as I now call it, the corporate media is, you have to find the lines. You know, it's sort of I don't know if it's between the lines, but you have to find the lines, which is sort of like between the lines. And here's a writer that follow a lot that online refers to Patrick Coburn. The great majority of people in Boswell were glad to see the British go, wrote the Independent Patrick Coburn from the city. And later on here, the Islamist takeover ensured that women, liberal progressives, and secularists such as university lecturers and human rights campaigners disappeared from the provincial and municipal councils and from public life. The region divided along ethnic, tribal, and political lines, while British and U.S. support of one side, ISCI, helped to polarize the Shia community further, exacerbating the conditions for endemic intra-Shia conflict. And here I have a note, DNC, divide and conquer within DNC. Washington's strategy was intended to drive a wedge between two wings of the Sunni insurgency, Baathists loyal to Saddam, and Islamist militants linked to Al-Qaeda, which had often previously worked in alliance. I'll read that again. Washington's strategy was intended to drive a wedge between two wings of the Sunni insurgency, Baathists loyal to Saddam, and Islamist militants linked to Al-Qaeda, which had often previously worked in alliance. The British policies reinforced sectarian and factional fault lines, an outcome typical of the colonial strategy of divide and rule. Then it gets on to Afghanistan, the new great game. Britain's current war in Afghanistan is relevant to the story in this book in two main respects. First, because Britain is now fighting Islamist forces it previously covertly supported, a fact which continues to go largely unnoticed in the mainstream media. Second, because Whitehall is again in effect colluding with Islamist actors to salvage what it can from Afghanistan and achieve fundamental foreign policy objectives. This entails, on the one hand, dealing with elements within the Taliban to promote a familiar divide-and-rule strategy in the country, and, on the other, collaborating with Pakistan when it is in reality extending a second round of support to Afghan insurgents, following that in the 1990s, when Islamabad largely created the Taliban to rule Afghanistan. I got lost in who's doing what there, but you get the gist, I think. By late 2009, the Taliban had shadow governors in 33 out of 34 Afghan provinces, up from 20 in 2006, and a permanent presence in 80% of the country, compared to 54% at the end of 2007. Translation, more Taliban. The British policy is likely a bigger recruiting sergeant for the Taliban than Al-Qaeda. And here's just horrible... you know, as with Iraq, potential or possible 1 million people, here's Afghanistan. Despite billions of dollars in aid allocated to Afghanistan in recent years, development is meager as a third of the population goes hungry and 73% have no access to safe drinking water. Human rights, notably for women, are deteriorating again. After an improvement following the fall of the Taliban in 2001, while the Afghan government, although elected, is as corrupt as ever and unwilling or unable to satisfy people's basic needs. All I can think of it is Bruce Coburn's song, and they call it Democracy. Let's see, a little farther on here, Middle East. Reports also suggest that many Afghans have turned towards the Taliban due to the high civilian casualties inflicted on the population, notably by the policy of bombing villages sheltering Taliban fighters, traditional British imperial practice in the Middle East since the 1920s, but now carried out by the U.S. Civilian casualties from the fighting have risen every year since 2001, and the number of deaths was estimated by the UN to be nearly 9,000 up to the end of 2010. Roughly a third of these are attributable to coalition or government forces. Of course, British forces realize the need to keep civilian casualties to a minimum. As Lieutenant General Nick Houghton, the MOD's Chief of Joint Operations, has explained, "We recognize that the kinetic eradication of the Taliban is not a sensible option and would act to alienate both the people locally and internationally. But while British and U.S. leaders stress that all steps are taken to minimize casualties, civilian, Human Rights Watch said in January 2010 that the U.S. and NATO have a poor track record in holding their forces accountable for attacks in violation of the laws of war that cause civilian deaths and injury. Yet a parliamentary inquiry report of February 2011 noted that the recent U.S. military surge has created more insecurity and that security in the country was worse than at any point in the past 30 years. Many independent witnesses to the inquiry gave evidence to the effect that the large-scale presence of troops in southern Afghanistan is one of the main causes of the conflict and that it specifically impedes Afghan peacemaking efforts. Because it reduces the pressure on the Afghan elite to make peace, because the Afghan government cannot deliver on any peace deal for as long as military strategy is outside its control, and because the Taliban are less likely to make peace with a government under foreign domination. Farther on, furthermore, Britain is again, in effect, colluding with the Afghan Islamist forces, albeit in a very different way than in the past. Knowing that a purely military conflict with the Taliban is unwinnable and with flagging domestic political support as British casualties rise, Britain has been forced to pursue a political end to the war by promoting negotiations with the Taliban. A rather desperate Whitehall is now dependent on cultivating relations and reaching agreement with radical Islamist elements to secure its exit from Afghanistan. The Brown government's analysis, which appears to be shared by its conservative liberal Democrat successor, was that there is no single authoritative leadership of the insurgency in either Afghanistan or Pakistan, and that the Taliban consists of at least six main factions. The insurgency in the south, including Helmand, which has the largest number of fighters and is led by Mullah Omar, the Haqqani and Hekmatyar groups in the east, and three groups in Waziristan in Pakistan belonging to tribes with different motivations. In this situation, British strategy is to fragment the various elements of the insurgency and separate the hardline ideologues from those who can be drawn into domestic political processes. So that's part of it, part of the line, the avoiding the hardline extremists. So it's quite a tangled web, as they say. And further on, the truth, quoting somebody, British strategy is one of separating those who want Islamic rule locally from those committed to violent jihad globally. The former can be part of an inclusive political settlement. The truth is that a lot of those who are fighting under the Taliban label are not global jihadists. Gordon Brown's foreign secretary, David Miliband, noted, Britain's other conditions for talks are that fighters should abide by the Constitution, renounce violence, and have no close operational links to Al-Qaeda, the word close being noticeable. That Britain has a purely pragmatic, expedient stance in dealing with extremist forces was confirmed by Britain's then ambassador to Afghanistan, Mark Sedwill, who said that it is wrong to describe the government as talking to moderate Taliban, as the media has reported, because it suggests there is a spectrum of ideology, and this isn't the way in which we expect it to go. It isn't a question of moderation or not moderation. It isn't really about their beliefs. It's about their affiliations and the reasons they drifted into the insurgency in the first place. It just strikes me as so, it just seems so hypocritical on one level, trying to manage the chaos, but, you know, then again, the which level of hardliners and jihadists and, but then again, you know, the whole thing being stirred up by the ones trying to control it, so it's, see how it gets confused on the news. And here's a line, thus Britain was again negotiating with a leading extremist Islamist group in order to help the Americans, and was apparently open to working further with it. And my note to that is like a bad relationship, but the sex is too good. Skipping through, simple bribes have been another aspect of the British divide and rule strategy. Army counterinsurgency field manual, it adds that money can be a substitute for force, offering a cost-effective means for pulling community support away from the insurgents. The key issue is the ongoing British and U.S. desire to control the crucial Middle East and Central Asia regions. In the next decade, two of the key challenges faced by Britain are competition for resources and the rising economic and political power of Asia. The war in Afghanistan is intimately bound up with Britain's very ability to conduct military intervention overseas. Not only could Afghanistan become a base for exporting terrorism, but the hugely intoxicating impact on extremists worldwide of the perceived defeat of the USA and NATO might inspire still bigger threats. Well, it seems like the fear card, but in a way that explains the could explain what to them is a logic for continuing at this point. They think they must continue at the risk of further extremists and further jihads. And the last section of this chapter, Pakistan. Oh, let's just sum up the Afghanistan. An additional factor in Afghanistan is the need for the British to uphold themselves to the U.S. General, to the U.S. General Donat said in May 2009 that Britain's military reputation and credibility has been called into question in the eyes of our most important ally due to some aspects of the Iraq campaign. Therefore, taking steps to restore this credibility will be pivotal, and Afghanistan provides an opportunity. These statements show that Afghanistan is not regarded by the British elite as an ordinary war, but that fundamental foreign policy interests are at stake. Moreover, securing these increasingly depends not only on the application of military force, but on the willingness of elements in the Taliban to play ball. Britain is now reliant on Islamist actors to secure what it would like to regard as an honorable exit from Afghanistan. And there's also been reports of the heroin, the poppies. I think it's like 90 or close to 100% of all poppy production in the world comes out of Afghanistan, and that leads to heroin. So that's a whole other side story you can look up yourself. Okay, a few more pages in this last section of this Pakistan chapter of Pakistan, Friend or Foe. Britain continues to work closely with Pakistan in its Afghanistan policy, but numerous reports suggest that Islamabad is aiding the Taliban beyond the policy noted of supporting Haqqani and Hekmatyar. WikiLeaks files have revealed the U.S. ambassador in Islamabad, Ann Patterson, noting in 2009 that Pakistan is covertly sponsoring four major militant groups, including the Afghan Taliban and Lashkar-e-Taiba. Recently on the news I saw, I forgot, I think it was CIA guy or FBI or somebody, yeah, I think it was CIA guy denouncing the WikiLeaks. So it seems like that's a new tack now. They're starting to feel threatened by information, so what do? They just denounce it as, you know, false stuff. Here's an issue of Nationalist Forces which threaten Pakistan's territorial integrity. So I'm going to read this longer section. First here, Pakistan has given the Taliban a free hand to operate from Quetta, Q-U-E-T-T-A, amidst Islamabad's huge military presence there. One reason is that Islamabad welcomes the Taliban's role in suppressing Balochi Nationalist Forces which threaten Pakistan's territorial integrity. British leaders have long been perfectly aware of Pakistan's role. In 2006 of September, for example, a confidential Ministry of Defense document leaked to the media suggested Pakistan's ISI intelligence agency was supporting the Taliban. The leak coincided with then-President Musharraf's state visit to Britain, and an embarrassed Downing Street issued the preposterous statement that the document did not reflect the views of the government. The British government has reportedly sent several dispatches to Islamabad asking that the ISI use its meetings with the Taliban to persuade the latter's commanders to reduce their attacks on Western forces, but the civilian government under President Asif Ali Zardari has either been unable or unwilling to break the ties that bind the ISI to the militants. Indeed, British military commanders in Afghanistan have long been reported as, quote, seething with anger at the ISI's support to the Taliban, end quote. The claim by some commentators that it is only renegade or former ISI officers who are supporting the Taliban appears false, and in truth, the ISI are a disciplined force tightly controlled for the most part by the Pakistani military. The ISI has provided vital components to the Taliban for using Stinger missiles which have been fired at British and U.S. pilots in Afghanistan. According to a CIA assessment, elements in the ISI also worked with the Taliban to bomb the Indian embassy in Kabul in July 2008. Similarly, a report by the RAND Corporation claimed that officers in Pakistan's Frontier Corps, which patrols the border areas with Afghanistan, even sometimes join the Taliban in attacking NATO and Afghan Army forces. Pakistan continues to regard Afghanistan as part of its sphere of influence, the reason Islamabad cultivated the Taliban and ensured its takeover of the country between 1996 and 98. Professor Sean Gregory of the University of Bradford argues that Pakistan continued supporting the Taliban after 9/11 despite its public stance, since it regarded the Taliban as its best instrument for achieving its objectives in Afghanistan, notably an end to the NATO presence and Indian influence in the country. So later on, then he mentions the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani Taliban, and then the Tehrik-i-Taliban. So as other shows of chapters have shown, there's a lot of times there are these multiple sects which make it even more complicated and confusing. And the last page of this chapter. Defying reality, present conservative ministers have continued to deliver various speeches and statements praising Pakistan for helping to stabilize Afghanistan. One rare exception came in July 2010, however, when during his visit to India, David Cameron went furthest in publicizing what British ministers have long known, accusing Pakistan of promoting the export of terror. Yet normal service was soon resumed. In April 2011, Cameron told a joint press conference with Pakistan Prime Minister Yousef Jilani that we both have an interest in a peaceful, stable, democratic Afghanistan. Following month, he remarked that Pakistan has suffered more from terrorism than any other country in the world. Their enemy is our enemy. So far from walking away, we've got to work even more closely with them. There are probably two key reasons for the conciliatory British stance towards Pakistan. First, as then Prime Minister Tony Blair reportedly insisted to the then commander of British forces in Afghanistan, General David Richards, Britain should go softly on Pakistan because of the ISI's cooperation with MI5 in catching Britain's domestic terrorists. This is a largely absurd position given the ISI's links with many of the terrorist groups connected to the same would-be British bombers the ISI is supposed to be investigating. Second, and more credible, as explained by then-Defense Minister Adam Ingram, the British and NATO force in Afghanistan is dependent on Pakistani support for the provision of a logistical line of communication from Karachi as well as permission for RAF overflights. Thus, the British war in Afghanistan has, if anything, reduced Whitehall's ability to influence Pakistan's sponsorship of terrorism. Indeed, the situation is truly absurd. In order to defeat the forces of the Taliban, Britain is dependent on their main ally. I'll repeat that one. In order to defeat the forces of the Taliban, Britain is dependent on their main ally. Britain's position is so weak that it has to rely on pro-Islamist forces to support the projection of British power, even when the strategy is self-defeating. Wow, what can you say about that? I mean, I've sometimes seen that personally or with people where there's like a conflict. I've seen it like literally as people get tired or it drains their energy or they get depressed because there's a conflict going on. Just like off the top of my head, you know, it's a sunny day, but someone has a beautiful new umbrella, so it's kind of like they're caught between wanting to use the umbrella because it's a new gift, but it's a sunny day, so, you know, without some kind of resolution or acceptance of some decision there, the person gets emotionally and decision-wise, you know, stuck. And so in this case, I don't know if it's a fair comparison, but in this case it's much more of a confusion and the clusterfuck of trying to control one thing and perhaps even, you know, the deliberateness of the chaos. But in any case, there's a convolutedness and tangledness with the countries, the sects, and who's trying to do what to who. So anyway, I can't say the book has a happy ending, but it leaves one with the gist of what the book is about. So in that sense, it's you know, you gotta fill in your own happy ending, really. So up to next show will be chapter 20, the good and bad revolutions, the Arab Spring. And maybe I can weave in the things I learned from this book, and you know, about the style of the book, just comments about the book that might be a more happy ending to end on. So I might be able to get that into the next show, or perhaps one more for that. So thank you again for listening, and reach out to get along with people, not to try to get between them. That's the message I get from this show, from this book, one of them. So thanks for listening. Have a good one.